There's a camera across the street, supposed to be protecting me, storing every little file. Make a promise and take a while. Hooked up to a satellite, make sure the world's behaving right. I don't mean to bust your groove, think it's time we made a move. Freedom isn't free tonight. Freedom isn't free tonight. Freedom isn't free tonight. I was indoctrinated here. Constitution, Paul Revere. And I'm not trying to be disloyal, but I ain't dying for your oil. And there's a camera on the bus. Are you with them? Are you with us? Surveillance at the traffic light, every friggin' megabyte. Freedom isn't free tonight. Freedom isn't free tonight. Freedom isn't free tonight. They're coming for me now. FBI. If they arrest you, please don't lie. Tell them you paid to hear me sing. Tell them you saw everything. And freedom isn't free tonight. Freedom isn't free tonight. Freedom isn't free. Isn't free tonight, tonight. I'm not trying to bust your groove. Think it's time for me to move. Freedom isn't free tonight.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program is Straight Talk about the Next American Revolution with Gar Apovitz.
Gar Apovitz argues that our economy needs to be more responsive to ordinary citizens and outlines his plan to transform the economy we have now. He also talks about the need to build on the Occupy movement.
Thank you all for coming. They asked me to introduce myself. As you probably guessed, my name is Gar Apovitz. I'm a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland, and I write books, but I'm trained as a historian and a political economist. Background, I was, I did a PhD at Cambridge University. I was a fellow of King's College, Cambridge, and fellow of the Institute for Politics at Harvard. And then I became much more interested in doing activist work along with my writing, and so I moved to Washington. We're in Wisconsin now. I'm a Wisconsin native, went to the university here at Madison, and I was also legislative director for Gaylord Nelson, the great senator from Wisconsin, and Bob Kastenmeier, who was a very liberal congressman. And so the last bit of introduction, I did policy planning work on United Nations matter at the State Department. So I have a checkered career. I come out of both politics and history and economics and different universities. And I've written this book. First, I should say I'm really pleased to be at this. This is a famous institution. The small bookstores like this, in my view, are the future and backbone of America. I've been lecturing around the country at MIT and Duke and NYU and Columbia. The real places where things happen are places like this, and so it's really a pleasure to be here. So this book, What Then Must We Do? The title is taken from Tolstoy, and it is drawn from Luke 4:10. That's where he got it. Probably, we don't know, but that's where it comes. And I stole his title because I thought it was appropriate to the question of the difficulties facing the country. What is it we shall do? What then must we do? And that's a question a lot of people are being asked around the country, in particularly. And I wrote this book in a very strange way. As some of you know, I wrote a very long book about the atomic bomb, about 700 pages of scholarly work, and other books that are very scholarly. And my wife teases me. She says, you know, how long is this book going to take you? 5 years? 10 years? You know, that kind of thing. And I've been working on what became the basis of this book for a long time, several years, maybe 5, 10 years, something like that. But I wrote this particular book in something that had never happened to me before. I wrote it in 3.5 months. It just poured out. And I decided to do it partly because of the mood that's developing in the country, and because younger people particularly are beginning to get into action. Occupy was one symbol of it. But a lot of other things are going on around the country that I've been involved with, and it seemed now's the time to speak to the possibility of change and activity and what's beginning to happen. So, and I also decided to write it in a style that I've never written before. It's very, very common sense, vernacular. It's like having a conversation, even a few jokes on the side. It's very fast-paced, but it's based upon heavy research, and if you look at the endnotes, you're going to find it. So that's enough background. Let me tell you what the book's about, and then we'll probably do some back-and-forth discussion on it. The first argument of the book is a kind of straightforward argument that most people don't often take seriously, but I think it's time to take seriously. Now, I told you I come out of conventional politics. I've worked in legislation, House, Senate, the government, so forth, and I left during the Vietnam War. So that period is over. But I come out of straight politics. I've done politics. I've been there, done that. And the first argument of the book is that the problems that are growing up in this country are not, strictly speaking, political problems. Now, they are political problems. But a better way to understand them, and this is the first argument, is that we are facing a systemic crisis, not simply a political crisis. Now, what does that mean? One thing it means is that if you elect the next guy, he's probably not going to be able to do much, even if we try to build a movement to shift it a little bit, and I'm for building a movement. Another way to look at what a systemic crisis is, and we will get to what then must be done if politics doesn't move the ball. Another way to look at it is long, long trends that don't change but get worse over time tell you you're dealing with something deeper down in the system than just what one election will do. So, for instance, the distribution of income has been getting steadily worse for 30 years. It's not about whether the Congress right now is blockaded and if there's a Tea Party. That certainly is a problem. But a 30-year trend doesn't tells you something else is going on much deeper. Or, for instance, virtually all of the economic gains, give or take small amounts, for the last 30 years, you really have to think about this, virtually all of the gains of the entire mammoth American economic system, virtually all, give or take, have gone to the top 1%. That's an extraordinary change. And we could get into criticizing the top 1%, but much more interesting is, what is it in the system that generates long, long trends of that kind? So that's another one. There's been virtually very marginal increase in average worker pay, a little bit over 30 years, but maybe less than a dollar over time. So this same long trends of decay there. Poverty has gotten worse, not better, over this period of time. And if we use about 14.5-16% range, if you used standards that are common in Europe or any other country in the world, poverty would be twice as high as it is in the United States. We use a very artificial standard of poverty, which was invented, oddly, by a government bureaucrat named Molly Orshansky, who picked up how much food in the late 50s, takes a food budget of a poor family, multiplied by three. No reason to multiply by three. She just multiplied by three, and that's the poverty line, increased by inflation. Most parts of the world, poverty is defined as half of the median income. Half of the median is the middle point in poverty. And by the world standard, we are double. And it says increased, not decreased, over time. So these are some of the kind of trend data that tell you that something's going on deeper down in the economic system and in the political system than you can tell by simply an election here or there. Oh, take another one. CO2 production has gone up steadily, 20%, 30% over the last X years. Civil liberties have gone down over time. Imprisonment, if you're interested in the value of liberty, imprisonment per 100,000 people in the United States is higher than any other advanced country by eightfold, eight times, and seven to eight, depends which country, including Russia and including China. And it has steadily gotten worse. So those are just some of the introductory things that make you say, we've been electing Democrats, Republicans, something deeper in the system is driving the long trends. We face a systemic crisis. You got to change the system if you want to change the trends. And that's the problem we face. And then, of course, the question is, what then is to be done? Because that is an overwhelming challenge to almost anybody who thinks about it in any serious way. So the first part of the book lays that out and tries to explain some of the reasons why that's so. One part of that, and it's important, particularly in Wisconsin, where you know the problem because of the difficulties you've had in terms of labor here, in the fight with Walker and the fights gone on over unions and public unions and so forth. Traditionally, the solution to economic and political problems in Wisconsin or in the United States in the last 50 years, and in Europe in the last 50 years, has been, in Europe they call it social democracy. In the United States we call it liberalism or progressives. So the way the process works is very simple. You structure the economy and give over ownership of large amounts of capital. You structure it to the corporations. They get to own the capital, and the elites get to own the capital. That's the nature of the economic system. And then when there are difficulties, inequality, problems with getting enough resources for public purposes, environmental difficulties, when there are difficulties, I'm going to let folks sit down as more are coming in. Come on in, sit down, and we'll carry on.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. And now back to the next American Revolution with Gar Opperbitz.
So the way the system is designed and the way the politics of the system is designed is that, and systems are about who gets to own the capital, who gets to own the wealth. The corporations and tiny elites in the United States and in most advanced capitalist systems own the large corporate productive part of the economy. Now, the give or take, but by and large that, well, let me give you a number. This number is so staggering that you have to just kind of let it sit there in your lap for a minute and look at it. In the United States today, 400 people, not percent, I said people, you probably could get them in this bookstore, own more capital, and mainly in corporate stock, the corporations, than the bottom 180 million people taken together. Just let that one sit there. That's the system, or one element of the concentrated ownership of wealth, largely corporate wealth, in this system. That's a medieval design. I said that at a lecture recently, and some historian, a medieval historian, came up that to me after. He said, no, it's wrong. It was never that concentrated in medieval times. But you live in an extremely concentrated system of ownership. So what is interesting is that system, when I worked in the Congress, and when most liberals still think about it in the following way, we can organize politics to either tax the they own the capital. We tax them and spend for good things, or we regulate them to deal with the environment, or we try to constrain and manage the system. That's basically what's called liberalism, and that's what's called social democracy in the design of the system abroad. And it's that process, which I was deeply involved with, both the House and Senate, and many people are still involved with, that's the process that is failing. And the reason you know it's failing, not marginally, is because the trends don't change. They just get worse. Now, that's a very, very challenging set of arguments, and it's an even more challenging reality. Now, very briefly, one of the main reasons that whole system is failing is because at the core of the progressive, you know, John Kenneth Galbraith called it countervailing power. The corporations have power, but we can countervail and manage, regulate, tax, and spend. At the core of that power was an institution, and a very important institution. It was called American Labor Unions. And that gave muscle to the progressive movement along with the movement activities. And the difficulty is, and this is happening all over the world, but nowhere as badly as here, labor has gone from 34.5% of the labor force as members of unions in the peak year, 1953. It's now gone down to 11.3% in the private sector, total, and something in the range of 6.6% in the private sector. So the labor organizations, unions, money and muscle for elections and progressive and liberal politics like Gaylord Nelson, the senator from this state, that whole system that kept the system in balance is decaying before your eyes. Now, obviously, this book, What Then Must We Do, goes into in more detail than I can sketch briefly. But the argument that we face a systemic crisis is that the old way of trying to bend the trends doesn't work anymore. So now you got a problem. There may be no way forward. That's a logical option. But if there is a way forward, probably it would have to get an underlying issue in all systems, which is who gets to own the wealth. And probably it would have to alter in some way that benefited the vast majority, the wealth. Somehow that would probably have to be done. Systems largely, and very briefly, are characterized largely by who does own the wealth, so that in feudalism it was landed wealth, and the lords and the church and the king owned the wealth, so they controlled the system. In 19th century capitalism, small farmers, they were small business farmers. They operated as businessmen. They sold in the market, not like peasant farmers. They produced something like Jacksonian democratic processes, very widespread ownership of wealth, private ownership. But that was a different 19th century small kind of capitalism. In the Soviet Union, the state owned the wealth, and the concentrated power there undermined democracy and liberty in that system. Now, the conservatives are, I'm not a conservative, but the conservatives were right about this. Put all the wealth in the state, and you got a real problem. And so were the anarchists, by the way. But that model is very difficult. So the compromise case, which was corporations own the wealth, we try to countervail, that's the one that's failing. Now, what are you going to do? Those are the systems we know something about. So either there is a new systemic direction that changes the ownership of wealth, or the pain continues. Very, very hard problem. I think we live at an extremely challenging moment in world history. It's not only here that this is happening, all over the world. What's happening faster here? What's interesting about the period, and this is the second major argument of the book, is that if you look beneath the surface of what's going on and what the press covers, and the press can't cover this because the press is under tremendous pressure. They're literally broke. They don't have reporters that can cover anything local, and they don't want to in many cases. But newspapers just don't have reporting staffs to do anything in depth anymore. But if you were able to do that, and we do a lot of research on this at the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland, it turns out that there's a lot going on that isn't being covered. And what is really interesting about it, if you think about systems, and you think about systems as they relate to who gets to own the wealth, is that one of the dominant characteristics is changing who gets to own the wealth, but in a radically decentralized way that maybe permits democracy to grow along with wealth ownership, unlike state ownership. So what do I mean? And I'll give you some statistics and some illustrations that are partly the result of past developments in American history and partly an explosion of things that's going on at the grassroots level that most people don't know about and that we've just done a lot of research about and reported in the book. So the most obvious example, and particularly in this state, a cooperative is a democratic ownership of wealth structure, very decentralized, but it does change. It's not a corporation, it's not the state, and it does change who gets to own and control wealth. 130 million Americans are members of cooperatives in the United States. Most people don't know that. A lot of them in credit unions, which are one person, one vote banks. It's right out here. It's very American. It has just being rediscovered the potential of what the cooperative movement might do. So for instance, let me give you an interesting example that somebody just sent me. I keep getting, because I write about this, and because I've been talking around the country, people keep sending me example after example after example that the press isn't covering. So this one's out of Burlington, Vermont. Many traditional credit unions are kind of stuck in the mud. They're very good institutions, but they don't do much creative. They will give you a loan for your car or your house, and that's it. They don't do much more than that. They aren't kind of investing in new kinds of, I'll give you some ideas of some of the creative businesses that are being developed. They're not taking risks at all. They're being much more cautious than most bankers. So that's kind of odd if you think they ought to be doing something more progressive. Well, if you actually look a little deeper, in most credit unions, they're run by very kind of run-of-the-mill guys who've been doing it for year in, year out. There is no democracy because nobody ever comes to the board meetings or comes to the election, to the annual meeting, because there's nothing to talk about. Why bother? And so the same people have been running it in the same way for a long time. But they are one person, one vote banks. And moreover, the credit unions in the United States combined have more capital than any one of the biggest banks, you know, in the United States, Bank of America. They have more capital. They're a big deal. So in some cities, in Burlington, activists who wanted to do something more creative simply start going to the board meetings and start going to the annual meetings and electing their own people. And that can be done and is being done in many parts of the country to take an existing possibility and begin to democratize it in fact rather than in theory. But the number to figure out, to hold on your head, is there's 130 million people involved already. There are 10,000 worker-owned companies in the United States, 11 million people involved, 3 million more than are members of unions in the private sector, and nobody knows about it. And some of them are good, some of them are bad, some of them are evolving, but they give you another way, and this is what we're talking about, to think about the proposition that if systems are about who gets to own the wealth, because power flows from wealth, and if you don't want it in the state because that over-centralizes it, then either there's a decentralized way or there isn't a way. Co-ops, worker-owned companies, credit unions begin to suggest another possibility. So I'll give you another illustration, and the book has a lot about this. Land trusts are an interesting model. What's a land trust? You draw a circle around an urban neighborhood or a rural neighborhood. You put up a nonprofit corporation, and you own the land. Now, what that means, so you take social ownership of the land through something like a nonprofit corporation. Now, what that allows you to do in a city, for instance, you can control land inflation and price inflation and housing inflation because instead of the developers making money on it, by owning it by a nonprofit corporation, democratizing the ownership, you can control that process. You don't have to kick people out of their houses. Or you can let part of the land go up and sell it to high rise or rent it to high rise, use the profits to subsidize housing. Because if you own the land or if you own the capital, you can take the profits and use them for other purposes, in this case, low-income housing. That used to be an idea, very oddball idea. There was one in Vermont 35 years ago, and there was one in Georgia 35 years ago. And people thought, that's crazy. They are all over the country now because you can't solve the problem. You can't get enough political power to tax and then spend, and so you get gentrification. You could go to a city like Irvine, California, where you would not expect it. 5,000 units of housing in land trust ownership. Chicago's doing it. Washington's doing it. Because, and here's the thing to note, because there's no other way to answer the problem. You can't regulate, you can't tax and spend. What's left is actually taking over ownership in some decentralized way. And land trusts are really interesting because they're popping up everywhere, and land is a big, big deal that most people don't pay attention to. I'll give you a few more illustrations. I won't bore you with this endlessly, but give you a couple. Most people are not aware that 25% of American electricity is socialized. You probably didn't know that. Public utilities and cooperatives produce 25% of American electricity. It is as common as grass throughout the country, including the South. And people are beginning to say, why don't we build on that tradition rather than just ignore it? So if you had looked at the New York Times about 2.5 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, the business page section had a front page big article, Power to the People. And it was all about the movement to make democratize ownership of utilities. There's a real hot one going on in Colorado right now, but there have been 16 or so in the last several years that have been taken over. So I'm giving you a picture of something developing at the grassroots level that the press isn't covering, but the most important characteristic is it's about who gets to own wealth, changing the power base of the system, and it is spreading. Why is it spreading? Because the pain levels are spreading. And people are desperate that you can't do it the old way. You can't tax and spend and elect a good guy. It doesn't work. So you've got to either roll up your sleeves and begin acting and changing things yourselves, or it won't change.
Coming up next, Malcolm X. He was an African-American Muslim minister and human rights activist. To his admirers, he was a courageous advocate for the rights of blacks, a man who indicted white America in the harshest terms for its crimes against black Americans. Detractors accuse him of preaching racism, black supremacy, and violence.
A white man, he wants you to remain a boy. He wants you to remain a lackey. He wants you to remain dependent on him. He wants you to come looking to him for some kind of advice or some kind of teacher. No, you teach yourself and stand up for yourself and respect yourself and know yourself and defend yourself and be yourself, and you'll be recognized as an intelligent person. I purposely say the government. That's who it is. FBI, CIA. They sneak around here in Harlem trying to frighten you into thinking that if you be a Muslim, you're going to catch hell. You already caught hell. You can't catch any more hell than you have caught. No, anytime you live in a government where its Federal Bureau of Investigation will spend its time running around here trying to frighten Negroes into thinking that they will be chastised for becoming Muslim, for accepting the religion of Islam, that government has fallen to a low level. Anytime, and the FBI does it. The FBI walks around here asking questions, trying to frighten somebody. They ought to be told this is a new day. Nobody afraid of any FBI. Why should they bother us? We obey the law. We respect the law. We teach our people to obey the law. They should thank us. They should try and get you to become a Muslim. But they don't want you to be a law-abiding person. They don't want you to be a respecter of the law. They want you to be a criminal. They want you to be a lawbreaker. They want you to be immoral so they'll have an alibi to come in and bust your head with their club. No, this is what the FBI does. And God's going to chastise them for using their power in the wrong way. No, that's what they do with their officers down there in the Department of Injustice, in the Department of Justice, calling themselves their respecter or protector of someone's rights. This is not fair for them to do this. They know what I'm saying is true. It's what they do. They come knocking on our door trying to frighten our little children. Are you a Muslim? What you look like asking our little children, is that child a Muslim? I tell the old devil, you must believe it too, or you wouldn't be wasting all your money trying to track us down. One of those old blue-eyed things had the nerve a couple of years ago to go to Philadelphia and tell the Muslims, they said Brother Malcolm is talking about white people and he's in New York living with a white woman. Imagine this. I told the brothers, next time the old FBI come and tell you that, you tell them that if I'm in New York living with a white woman, it's his mother.
And now for something completely different.